Vincent Aiello is a distinguished U.S. Navy fighter pilot, Top Gun instructor, and the host of the popular podcast, The Fighter Pilot Podcast. With a career that spans decades of aviation experience, Aiello has not only flown some of the most advanced fighter jets in the world, but also played a pivotal role in training the next generation of elite naval aviators. After retiring from active service, he transitioned to sharing his wealth of knowledge and experiences with aviation enthusiasts and aspiring pilots. Through his podcast, Aiello offers an insider's perspective on the world of military aviation, diving into the challenges, triumphs, and intricacies of flying high-performance jets. His contributions to the aviation community have made him a respected voice both in the skies and in the podcasting world. So, Vincent, welcome to Hear Us Out.
Thank you very much, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here. And hello, Michelle.
Hi, pleasure to have you.
So why don't we start off and have you tell us about some of what you've been working on lately?
Well, golly, never a dull moment for me. I've been working on the Fighter Pilot Podcast. As always, we are in our eighth year. Thank you for mentioning that. I'm also an airline pilot, which, you know, it's not a difficult job until it is. And so I try to keep up on that. I still make myself flashcards to remember how to do something in case it happens in a moment. And then my real big news is that I am just about to launch my memoir, and I'm calling it Through the Yellow Visor, because I used to wear a yellow visor, which was sort of unique to me. And it chronicles my origination story from an eight-year-old attending his first air show all the way through my career, and then a little bit at the end talking about what you led with. So thank you for that.
What I have to ask is, going from fighter jets to being a commercial pilot, how do you make that transition in terms of the excitement of the machinery that you're working with?
Well, you just have to tell yourself it's totally different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to be honest, when I left the Navy and went to the airlines, I was 46 years old and I was ready to start slowing down a little bit. You know, after a while, you've been there, done that. Your body starts to ache at you a little bit when you do the things you used to do in your 20s and 30s when you were made out of rubber. And so, you know, it's not quite as exciting, and that's okay because it compensates well. My family and I enjoy the travel privileges. I get to meet people. I even do a lot of charter flights. So I've taken baseball and basketball teams and hockey teams different places. And so it's just a new chapter of my life, and it's one I'm embracing, and I'm good with that.
Any specific challenges that come along with that kind of transition?
Absolutely. So before, I flew mostly single seat aircraft, so I could in effect do what I wanted and didn't have to check with other people. Now, of course, the pilots out there are throwing things at the speakers right now, because you don't just do what you want. You're always a coordinated mission in the military. But I didn't have to check with another crew member, hey, you know, heads up, we're about to turn or something like that. The airlines are totally different. They want you to do everything by the book every time consistently, because that's how they stay safe. Mm-hmm. And so just that transition to there's another person, and this is the way my airline wants us to do it, and these are the things you should say and do and not do. So yeah, it's just, I can't think of a good analogy suddenly, but you know, you rise to the occasion. I think most people do with no trouble, because you just know it's different.
Can you speak to the difference in responsibility in flying for the military versus flying commercial? And if you feel a different sense of responsibility in both of those?
Yes, that's a really intriguing question, Eric, because there is a tremendous amount of responsibility in each, but it's very different. In an FA-18 that I used to fly, the responsibility could be that you could affect whether the mission is accomplished that day or not, depending on if you execute the brief as it was presented. And you could also, of course, have very catastrophic outcome if you don't do your job right, whether you maybe attack the wrong target or you don't land on the carrier correctly. And the YouTube and others are full of videos of sensational scenes of what happens when you don't do that right. And so in that case, it was very consequential in so much as I could affect whether the United States of America achieved its mission in attacking something. And more locally, I could affect my own life and my squadron and air wing if I, say, crashed and either killed myself and or someone else And all of that is very consequential. And to compare that to what I'm doing now, right? Both of you, I presume, fly on commercial airlines and you have loved
Yes.
ones who do. You don't want me to be flippant about my job, do you?
Nope.
So it's an entirely different type of consequentiality, if that is in fact a word. And really, it for the most part, it goes well. Obviously, in recent news, it hasn't gone so well. But my airline alone flies something like 4,000 flights a day during peak season. And most of those, we in the regular public don't hear anything about. So for the most part, it goes well. So I just try to do my job the best I can so that I don't get highlighted. And the people in the back, frankly, right? I mean, yeah, sure, they want to hear from the pilot and feel good about it. Ultimately, they just want to get where they're going safe and on time. And so that's what I try to do.
You deal with the unexpected circumstances that can happen in flying, whether it's certainly weather conditions or even passenger conditions. I heard my own family just went on a flight recently and somebody got sick on the plane and then it derails everything. How do you kind of navigate that internally and then externally when something doesn't go as expected?
Certainly, there's just a tremendous amount of training that is presented to pilots. And so you can't account for every possible contingency, but you can have a pretty good idea of, hey, do we need to go somewhere other than where we plan to go? And it could be because of a misconduct or a health situation, as you just identified, or even an aircraft discrepancy or malfunction. And so you just learn that, can I categorize this into something I'm used to dealing with, or at least I've thought about dealing with? And then the other thing is, you just what we call chair fly. You just sit, sometimes when I'm a passenger, which I end up being quite often to get where I need to go, I think about, well, what would I do right now if I were the pilot and we lost an engine? Which airport would I go to, or what would I think or say or do? And so I think it's just maybe like anything where you just have to stay sharp by practicing. And for an athlete, that could be throwing the ball or running the race, or at least training, right? For a musician, it's picking up your instrument. For a pilot, it's doing it a lot because I notice when I do take a break, I'm not as proficient or comfortable. But it's also thinking about it because what would I do if something happened right now? And you want to be ready.
One of the things we've spoken with another pilot about is the idea of taking really complex information and breaking it down so that it's accessible to people who aren't necessarily educated in your field. And for pilots communicating with their passengers, do you take note of the idea that a lot of people who may be flying with you may be in a rush, may not be comfortable, may be out of their comfort zone, and are really looking to you to be calmed and to be comforted, which may not be your primary role? How do you manage that from the pilot seat?
Yes, and in fact, my company really loves when we, as pilots wearing our epaulets and tie and hat and everything, spend time speaking with the passengers and our customers, whether it's in the gatehouse, particularly if there's a delay, we'll grab the PA and say, hey, this is what we're waiting on, this is what we think we hear, how long it'll be, that kind of thing. But also on the airplane, one of the techniques I use, and my company suggested this, and I actually enjoy it, is on the single aisle aircraft, the 757 that I fly. I also fly the 767. It's a little harder on that one. But on the 75, I can grab the PA at the front of the cabin and welcome everyone. And I usually do right about the time they're just about to close the door. And I just want them to look at me and I hope say, that guy looks like he knows what he's talking about. And not for any other reason, like I'm a male or white or anything else, but just that guy looks, that person, that pilot looks like he knows what he's talking about, and I feel comfortable. And so I usually tell them, welcome aboard. This is where we're going. This is what we might fly near or over when on the way. So that's interesting to people. And oh, by the way, you've got four of our company's finest flight attendants on board. They're here primarily for your safety, but they're also my representatives. So I just kind of lay some groundwork right away. And I have had people tell me later, like, hey, I appreciate you doing that. And sometimes getting back to the top, Eric, I'll even tell them, particularly if my first officer is also former military, I may say something like, hey, my name's Vincent. I'm flying with Doug today. Together, we have over 50 years of combined civil and military flight experience. So just trying to make people feel good. And ultimately, yes, as your question eloquently stated, there are some that are uncomfortable. Most like look up, yeah, whatever. Just get me where I'm going. And every time you talk on the PA, it interrupts the movie I'm trying to watch on the seat back. So
I'm glad you acknowledge that.
Absolutely.
You had mentioned a little bit earlier about the way to get good or feel comfortable is to do it a lot. And something I appreciate about our field is we have the time to spend with patients to get comfortable. For you, it's a whole different realm, though, of that you don't really have the time and the flexibility to do it as many times until you feel comfortable because you have people's lives in your hands. So at what point in your career did you start feeling competent and that you can do this independently? How did you learn to feel good about it?
I think that just comes with time. And for some, it comes faster than others, right? We all know people who seem to never struggle with anything. And certainly Hollywood likes to depict fighter pilots that way. You know, we're very cocksure, almost egomaniacs who have never had any issue in anything. But for me, you know, I wasn't that way. I always felt like I had to work twice as hard as everyone else. So for my military career, I would say it was about the time I left my very first fleet squadron and went to Top Gun. And then I was surrounded by other Top Gun instructors, and I felt inferior to most of them, frankly. So I think it's a function of your own lot in life and how you compare yourself to others. But, you know, certainly about the 10-year mark of flying fighters, I think it was. And then, you know, every time I, in the airline world, just about got comfortable, I either switched airplanes or switched seats. And I've been a captain now for a couple of years. And when I fly regularly, I feel pretty comfortable. But I try not to get too comfortable because that's when you can get complacent.
That all makes sense. And yeah. You brought up being a Top Gun instructor. Can you speak to how you instruct your or how you instructed your students to prepare for the physical demands of flying? I've heard you speak on your podcast and with others about some of the physical challenges you experienced when you first started flying on fighter jets and in those training missions. How do you get your students to really understand what their body is going to experience?
Sure, Eric. But let me just make a caveat that by the time a student gets to Top Gun, that's almost understood or assumed. Mm-hmm. But it's still a good question because we all face that early on in our jet training. And in fact, the one and only fatality Top Gun has ever had in its 50 plus years of training was due to a G loss of consciousness scenario mm-hmm. where the student might have either been, I don't know for sure, but either tired or dehydrated or just overwhelmed. Maybe they were midway. I think they were midway in the course at the time. And so you just have to hold each other to a high standard. You have to look each other in the eye and say, are you here today? Are you ready? A quick aside, I once had a flight surgeon address the ready room, and he told us that maybe we should, right before we go to the airplane, usually our last stop is the bathroom, and he suggested maybe we should check the other fella's color of his urine to see if he's properly hydrated or not. We all got a good laugh out of that.
Some truth to that, though.
Yeah.
Well, there is, but the act of it is it could be construed as something maybe that's – anyway, moving on. So you hold each other to a high standard. You expect that if you're not – here today for whatever reason, you have a new baby, cried all night, you didn't get good sleep, or something going on with your parents or your wife or anything, you gotta hold, raise your hand. You know, just like right in basketball, if someone gets a foul, a lot of times the player raises his hand. Yep, that was me. And so it's that way in our business too, because what we do is very difficult on the body. It's very difficult on the mind. And it's not just, oh, you could go out on your bicycle or motorcycle and hurt yourself. No, you could destroy a $100 million airplane, and you could obviously hurt or damage or kill something or someone else. So you just have to show up.
Have you encountered instances where you felt like somebody hadn't shown up and you needed to step in, whether it was in the classroom or whether it was in the prep room to go out on a mission?
Well, I know that happened to me. I woke up one morning and we'd had a fun night the night before. I'll leave that to the listener's imagination, but I realized I was in no condition to operate that day. So I removed myself from the flight. Not necessarily that I can remember, Eric. Mm-hmm. I think generally what happens is you'll come back from a flight and the pilot or the crew will just, you can just tell something's not right. And sometimes, we're all very type A. Nothing's ever wrong. We're going to show up every time, every day, and be good. And most of us are, but not all of us all the time. And so you look for these indicators, and then at some point when no one else is around, if you've put in the investment emotionally with this person prior to this, you can say, "Hey, what's going on?" And usually in that instant, as soon as they know someone cares, and they're not near anybody else, either it's, "No, I'm good. It's just an off flight," or the eyes turn glassy, the shoulders relax, and it's, "Yeah, my wife is sick, or my child is not doing well, or my parents are aging." And it's usually right there, and you can get to it. And you don't have to embarrass the guy or gal and go say it to the mountaintop, but like, "Hey, you know what? Why don't you take a couple of days off, or why don't we, just let's figure out what's going on here?" Because again, you don't want to overlook those indicators.
Is there ever a way to fully prepare them mentally for what to expect for something like this?
I think it happens slowly over time, Michelle. I don't think you could take someone off the street and put them straight into a ready room. And, even like if you remember the movie Matrix, "Hey, I need a program to fly a such and such helicopter," said Trinity. "Okay, boom, you got it." If you could do that and put you in the ready room, I don't know. I mean, of course, it's a movie, so it's entertaining, right? But it takes time. You have these conversations with each other. You have presentations similar to the one I just regaled you with, of the flight surgeon, on how to be ready and be your best. But we have others on, "Hey, in my case, I was on aircraft carriers mostly. So we have time to transit over to wherever we think we might operate." For me, that was mostly over Iraq. And on that transit, we talk about, well, what's in Iraq right now? What threats do they have? What aircraft? Are they even flying those aircraft? Or is it mostly surface-to-air missiles? What are the folks on the ground doing? And so you think about it, you ruminate, you talk, you go through scenarios in the ready room with each other. And it really helps you to, again, kind of back to that earlier question, chair fly. What would I do right now if this thing happened? Well, what am I going to do when I get there so that it's not foreign and new and a little bit scary? You've thought about it before you get there.
You talk about flying over Iraq. When you're in a situation like that, in a mission, does it feel real? Does it feel, as an outsider, somebody with no experience in that front, what I could only imagine it would be? When you're in that cockpit by yourself, are you feeling aware of the gravity of what you're about to do? Or is there some disconnect within that?
I wouldn't say there's a disconnect, but you almost put that aside a little bit. And if you want to call that a disconnect, I suppose you could. But you somewhat compartmentalize what, I don't know how to put this exactly. There's certain parts of it you set aside for now so that you can accomplish the mission or do the tasking as it's been given to you. And I'll give you an example. And I don't mean to keep coming back to my book, but it's
Yeah,
fresh on my
no,
mind.
do
Be
it.
No, well, because I wrote it, so it's fresh on my mind. It's in the book. On my second deployment in my first squadron, so I was a young lieutenant. I might have been, golly, 20, what year was that? So I might have been 28, 29. Well, Iraq had started kicking out. This was 1999. It had started kicking out and harassing the United Nations and inspectors and saying, "No, you're not allowed to be here. Beat it." And they were taking pot shots at us, and we had responded in kind to them. Well, we were flying over, and our mission that day was to go just take a look at some different sites that intelligence suggests could be a building of anti-aircraft defenses that are in parts of the country that they should not be. And so we went and put our forward-looking infrared or FLIR on this coordinate we'd been giving, and all of a sudden it starts blinking at us. And I'm thinking, what is that? That looks like a practice munition hitting, because our practice munitions don't have explosives; they just have a little charge, so you'll see it. And I was, like I said earlier, pretty junior still. And the executive officer of our sister squadron, who was leading our flight, he goes, "Heads up, they're shooting at us." I'm like, "Oh yeah, golly, that's what that is." And I didn't ever feel any fear, but I just thought, "Oh, all right, fine. Well, hey, guess what? That's what we came to find out." So we extended a little in the direction we were flying. We turned around and we came and we bombed them, and they weren't shooting at us anymore. And when we landed, my wingman and I high-fived, and we're like, "That was awesome." And later I said, "Wait, was that awesome? I mean, number one, the bomb we dropped was probably more expensive than the AAA gun shooting at us. But number two, what if I killed somebody?" And at the time, intelligence had suggested that the Iraqis would come out and take pot shots at us and then run back to the safety of their bunkers. And so that's just what I tell myself, and that's just a coping mechanism. But even if that isn't the case, well, this is war to a degree. And so I had a chance to kind of ruminate on that, but there was no evidence that there was any kind of death, but certainly my bomb hit the gun that was shooting at us. And I just decided this is what I've been trained to do, and this is what I do. I'm not going to revel in it. I'm not going to ask for a conflict so that I can go do it. But it certainly is nice to know that what you train so long for, that you can do it and do it well. And that was my mission that day, and I achieved that. So I was satisfied in my own ability to go out and do the thing. And when it sunk in later, when I didn't have stick and throttle in hand, yeah, it was a mix of emotions.
Is there almost like a intense acceptance of those that are your commanding officers, a trust in what they are asking of you that this is right and it is my responsibility to carry it out?
I would say, in my experience, it always was. Yes, Eric. Our commanding officers in the squadrons were maybe 40 years old, and maybe a little older, 45, let's say. But at any rate, they had been there, done that themselves. They had started off just like I was in 1999 as a young lieutenant and worked their way up, and in fact demonstrated to the Navy that they were worthy of the being bestowed the honor of commanding a squadron. But ultimately, they answered to their bosses, which was the air wing commander. And the air wing commander answered to his or her boss, which was the strike group commander who was right there on the carrier. And so, yeah, I never was given an order, or we never went and flew anywhere where I didn't believe in what we were doing. And I don't think I was brainwashed. I just think at the time our country was on the right course, and there were other countries that were not behaving well, in my opinion, and most others. And so I never. I think the one or two things I ever got annoyed about, if you will, if that's what you're looking for, is just, we're not flying today already. That's bad enough. Now you want yet another meeting, that we can talk about this or the other. So you might, get a little frustrated at that. Plus, you're cooped up on this 1,000-foot-long ship with 5,000 type A people. So of course there's going to be, instances like that, but not when it re came to flying, no.
Yeah, what I think captivates me is kind of the human experience of all of this, that here you're having this opportunity to kind of push the limits of technology and what our technology can do and the thrill and responsibility of that, but you're also coupling that with warfare and the challenges that that poses. So I think for our listeners to have an understanding of the humanity for the people involved that, hey, you go home and you go to sleep at night after you go through your missions. And we want to better understand that experience and the challenges of that.
And it is, I think, a very interesting conversation to have, Eric, because I can remember flying off the aircraft carrier and going and landing back at my home base and being home, let's say, another half hour after that. And to think, wait, 3 hours ago, I was on an aircraft carrier. Now I'm home with my kids and the toys and everything else. And it's a really interesting paradigm. I think it doesn't just happen with a flip of a switch. You know, going into this community, what you're going in for. And there are people, right or wrong, who are attracted to a life in the cloth of a nation's military. And I'm glad there are still, frankly, because that's a whole separate conversation.
Of
But that was the path that I think chose me. And I desperately wanted to do it, and I did, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. The flying was everything I hoped it would be, but what I really enjoyed and what kept me around was the camaraderie with the men and women with whom you serve. And there was nothing else like that. I haven't found that in the airlines because it's a little more sterile. You do your job and you go home, and you may or may not fly with that first officer again. So I think it's a calling. It's not for everyone. My oldest son is a bit of an artist, and he apologized to me one time. He said, "Dad, I thought maybe I could go in the military for a few years, but then go do this thing." And I stopped him. I said, "Hey, son, you don't have to go serve just because I did. If there's no one to serve, there cannot be service. So I'm glad you acknowledge that. Hopefully, one of your brothers or someone else will, because there's a balance." So I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but it is a consequential life, and I was glad to have a part of it.
Now, we're audiologists, so we care a lot about hearing. So, how have you seen ear protection in service commercially? How has it changed over time, whether for
Well,
you or what you've seen?
sure. And before we get to that, Michelle, can I give you a little backstory on my personal experience? And again, not to keep beating the bush here of the book,
Please.
but the reader will see this in the book. So early on, I tried to be in the Navy, and they sent me this letter saying, "Hey, sorry, you can't even be in the Navy, let alone be a fighter pilot." And that was because I had been diagnosed with cholesteatoma when I was 12 years old. And I assume you both know what that is.
Yes.
Your
Yes.
listeners may not, but if I remember correctly, it's like a skin-lined cyst in the inner ear canal between like the eardrum and the canal. And it was flagged on me on one of these audiology tests where the van comes to your school and just tests all the kids. And I'm just pushing the button all merrily, thinking, oh, they really like my right ear. I don't know why they're not asking about my left. And so, sure enough, my mother got a notice, and I went to an ear, nose, and throat doctor. And he looked in and he goes, "Yeah, here's a problem." And he even showed it to my mom. And so I had that removed, and my hearing did improve in my left ear. It's never been as good as my right. Like Dick Cheney, I sometimes still move my right mouth to the right when I talk. I have to, I have to counter it. So for me, I had that drama from the beginning. So hearing was always very important to me. And I learned a little bit about hearing and how once it's gone, it's gone. Unlike other parts of your body, I had a friend who was in a motorcycle accident and it ground down the nipple on his chest and it grew back. And I never knew that till I interviewed him for the Fighter Excel
Fascinating.
podcast. Yeah.
Learn
So
something new
hearing,
every day.
yeah, hearing you don't get back. And so I've tried to preserve it. I've always been a little cautious that the Navy was going to change their mind after all and not let me fly or stay. And so when I was, now to your point, a young pilot, I would put earplugs under my helmet when both walking out to the airplane and in the airplane. And at one point in the FA-18A through D Hornet, that's just the regular Hornet, not the Super Hornet, I found that the regular foamies were too strong in a sense. I couldn't get the radios up loud enough, but there's a lot of ambient noise in a cockpit, as you might imagine. So I would flatten it with my thumb and I'd take a little pocket knife and I'd cut it in half longitudinally and I'd put a half in each ear instead, just trying to preserve whatever I could. So, yeah, for me, it was always important. Others were a bit more flippant about it. And I can't say I've always been a saint. If I go shoot shotguns with friends at clay pigeons or something, I sometimes don't wear hearing protection, which is a big no-no, I'm sure.
I would almost think being on an aircraft carrier that the jet engines are so loud that even with protection in, just through the vibration, through bone conduction, that you're getting
Okay.
significant noise exposure, and that you almost can't protect against. So you can protect the sound going in your ear, but you can't protect against the huge intensity of the vibrations that these engines are going to throw off.
So right, Eric. The EA-6B Prowler, which has since been retired from the Navy, was particularly known for being just brutal. And I don't know what you know about aircraft carrier operations, but if you've ever seen the videos or the movies, they'll have an airplane that's about ready to catapult off, and they have this barn door that folds up out of the flight deck behind it to both protect other aircraft, but also give it something to push off with its jet exhaust. That's called a jet blast deflector. And they'll have other aircraft right behind it waiting their turn. And the worst thing ever was sitting behind an EA-6B Prowler in tension, as we call it, which is where your throttles are full up, but you're still sitting there waiting to get shot. And yeah, you'd sit in the cockpit and you're bouncing and everything's rattling. You can't hear the radios. Yeah, there are a lot of retired pilots like me who don't score so well on those audiology tests
Yes.
in their later life.
I can understand why.
Yeah.
And Michelle sees those patients.
I do. I see a lot of they're my favorites. The
Okay.
veterans.
Yeah.
I was almost wondering if like helmet design even can help with protecting against vibration, but I'm sure it can't.
That's probably out of my wheelhouse, but I'll tell you this. I've often asked the different folks in charge of these things, why don't they put sound cancellation in the earmuffs that go over your ear, or let us put something in our ears before? And I'm thinking they've got something like that now. I've seen people wearing the form fit earplugs, and they can put a little microphone in it, so that's better than nothing. Certainly better than the foamies. I started getting fit for that at one point. There you go. And I forget what happened. I transferred in the middle of the process or something. So I think it's, a lot like most things in life. You start doing something And then you start to learn what it is you're doing and the effect it's having, whatever pursuit that may be. There's all the consequences downstream of the things we do. And certainly the effects on our bodies, the effects on our hearing, us being pilots here, fighter pilots specifically, it can take a toll. And of course, even before you ask it, I feel like you might, I'll just say, well, some might say, well, then we shouldn't be doing that. And I'd say, well, I don't know about the rest of you. To me, the goal of life is not to make it to 120 in a perfectly preserved body with no damage or scars or anything. Yeah, okay, fine. I've damaged my hearing, but man, did I have some amazing experiences. And I don't want to live forever anyway. I've seen just too much weirdness and made too many poor choices and st said too many stupid things to people that I can't take back to want to live forever. So,
It shows you that you've lived life.
indeed, indeed.
We've heard similar things from musicians where it's like, hey, I know I'm taking a degree of risk exposing myself to this noise. A football player knows they're taking a degree of risk in playing, but that's the life they want to live. That's the human experience they want to have. And I think also as providers, we need to understand that it's not something to necessarily be lecturing about, but maybe we educate people and you make an informed decision that, hey, being a fighter pilot is worth the noise exposure that you're going to have. And that makes sense to me.
I totally agree. I guess the one exception I might say is if a fighter pilot wants to bring his infant who doesn't have a choice and sit next to the right loud exhaust, that's a different story. And I don't see anyone doing that. But yeah, I mean, look, give me the information, let me make a decision, and then don't tell me what to do or not do unless it's really hurting someone else. I mean, anyway, we could go on a tangent on that, I'm sure, but.
Now, we've spoken a lot on the podcast about being a part of people's stories, where seeing how our guests may have had an impact on those around them. Can you think of a time where you may have become a part of somebody else's story where you have had an impact on somebody else, whether it's a passenger, somebody else in your crew, or
Oh
otherwise?
gosh, yes, absolutely. I mean, being a Top Gun instructor was incredible because we had students that would come through and they're eager to learn, and you can impart upon them the information that they need. And when they get that patch and go back out to the fleet, you might bump into them later and you might have a story about a flight or a laugh about a time in class. And so just to know that they remembered the instructors that they flew with, and I remembered in many cases the students, particularly when they would unfortunately pass away in mishaps. The very first FA-18 WISO, weapon systems officer, who went through Top Gun was when I was on the staff. And unfortunately, he and three others were killed in a collision of two Super Hornets. And so that was very sad. But I would say for me, it was just the people that you had served with, bumping into them again at various weird points around the world in the Navy was great. And then, as Eric said at the top, I have this podcast now, and it shares this world with people who are interested in it. And it's unlike the movies because the movies are sensational, and that's fine. But mine, I try to be as authentic as possible. And every so often, on an airliner at the end, someone might come up and say, "Hey, I thought I recognized your voice. You're so and so, from the podcast. You're Jello." And but even if it's not because of the podcast, again, getting back to what we were discussing earlier, my airline likes the pilots, once we're done with our duties, to go back and say goodbye and thank you to passengers as they deplane. And many of them say, thank you for getting us here safely or for taking care of us. And again, every once in a while, one will recognize me, not very often. And so I wouldn't say I need that for my ego, but it's certainly nice to know that you did a job well done in both cases. And so it satisfies me to know that I've made a difference to someone that they recognize.
In referencing the students that you were able to teach, can you talk about what aspects of leadership maybe led those in your charge to really respect you beyond your rank and title, but you, the individual?
I would say first and foremost, it's authenticity. If you're purporting to be something or someone you're not, people can see through that in a heartbeat. You probably see that in your line of work as well. The blowhards, the nothing's ever wrong, oh, that's not my fault, that's someone else's fault when there is a setback, they don't last long in military aviation. And so I think for me, I was authentically myself, even when it wasn't pretty. I mean, I would say, as I said earlier, I would say and do things at times that I wish I could take back. And that's just because I was raised in an environment and became the person I am where I don't know. That's just who I am. I wasn't necessarily a great leader. I would like to hope I wasn't a terrible one either. They won't write books about me. I had to write my own, and I tell people right up front, it's not a leadership book. I led, but ultimately it's because I subscribed to what it was we were supposed to be doing. I led with the authentic me, warts and all, and I had owned up to when I was wrong. And I had other people's best interests in my heart as well. And so I think for me, that's what worked. Other people made it look much easier and seemed to always do it well. And thankfully, those are the ones that typically percolated to the top. And it helps that if you are one of those people that you know what you're talking about, right? Again, you're not just making it up and you can do it well. And some of us struggle with one or the other thing. And so I think the Navy, for the most part, does a good job of recognizing those who have the skills and the leadership, and they, generally speaking, make their way up the ranks.
We do actually, really, Michelle does more of it, of the testing of the veterans. So there's outside agencies that contract with the government to then get veteran services through private clinics like ours. And one of the responsibilities of doing those tests is when we greet the veterans, we're supposed to say thank you for your service. And then at the end of the testing, we say thank you for your service. I've always been curious from the veteran's perspective how it is to hear that, because there's something in the idea of being required to say something that makes it feel less authentic, even when we mean it. So I'm curious how it is being on the receiving end of that.
It depends on the setting. If you can tell it's either forced or trite, then it's like, my typical response to people is thank you for your support, because it just sort of diffuses it a little bit and it kind of puts it back on them instead of just, oh, you're welcome, which I say once in a while as well. I'll say this. I mean, it's a simple question, Eric. It's not a simple answer, because I still feel, although I was a child when the Vietnam War ended, but I still feel a pang of guilt for the Vietnam veterans who didn't hear that very much. And I feel like the pendulum for a while there, particularly immediately after 9/11, almost swung too far the other way, and it's particularly after Desert Storm as well, where suddenly, like, you couldn't buy your own drink at a bar, or you'd get discounts everywhere, and that was great. But ultimately, I'll confess this. I wanted to be a fighter pilot because I thought it would be an amazing job and really interesting experiences with fun people, and it was. It was all those things, and I got paid to do it. And so when people say thanks for your service, like, well, I would have done it anyway. I probably would have done it for less. It was amazing. And so I don't feel like, for me, it was a gigantic sacrifice. Now, that's
That was my next
probably a
question.
crazy thing. Yeah. Well, and my wife would probably punch me if she was sitting next to me, because, I was gone on aircraft carriers for over 3 years when you add it all up cumulatively. I'm glad to say, present for the birth of all three of my children, but, deployed multiple times with them at different ages, including to Afghanistan in 2011 and 12, when they were, golly, what were they? Seven, four through 11 or something. And so that was difficult, but I never thought of it as, oh, poor me, I need someone to tell me I'm doing this well or a good job. I just kind of knew it when I signed up. And even the night I met my wife, as we got to know each other a little bit, I told her, I said, look, I'm in the military. I want to be a fighter pilot, and this is what I think that's going to mean. And, right or wrong, she went along for the ride. So you'll have to get her on and see if that was a good decision or not. But I usually just honor the back to your question. I honor the intent of the acknowledgement that I served, and I was glad to do it.
You had mentioned a little earlier about the kind of instructor that you were, that there are things you maybe wish you could have taken back, but it's kind of not how you were raised to be an instructor. What shaped you into the instructor that you became?
Probably most of the other people who had a fingerprint on my career up until that point. And one, if I can name him, Jeff Winter, call sign Chili, he had come from Top Gun to my squadron before I left that squadron to go to Top Gun. And he was just one of these guys that was seemed like good at everything, tall and handsome, great in the airplane, good in the ready room with people, friendly, outgoing. It's just like, man, I want to be like him. And he was, frankly, the reason I was able to go to Top Gun, because he reached back to the staff and said, "Hey, I think you should take this Jell-O guy." And so, you know, he had a big imprint on me. My commanding officers, the other squadron members, and the other Top Gun instructors, some more than others, some the chemistry is not there, right? But you can still learn from them as well. And so I would, in my case, my personality is I'm quick to dismiss something going well, and I'm quick to accept responsibility and internalize something going poorly. And that's just who I am as a human being. And I'm not necessarily proud of that, but it just is what it is. And so, you know, there were times when I would get a talking to or a suggestion or a nudge or whatever it was. And I would really ruminate on that and say, gosh darn it, you know, what did I do? What could I do better? And of course, those never go away, right? Nobody's got that figured out. And so I've had to try to tell myself over time that, hey, you're not as bad, you know, as you seem to be thinking you are. People like you and you know, you're doing a good job. And the Fighter Pilot podcast helped with that too. You know, people mm-hmm. would write the show and say, "Hey, yeah, you're doing great." And I would sit and listen to myself and say, "Oh, you said that wrong," or you know, and that's because there's such a high standard at Top Gun, which we can get into if you want. But for me, I internalized and just always sought improvement. And that's great to a point, because mm-hmm. you never get to perfection. And so it can be kind of damaging too, over the long run, but it's great to keep you headed in the right direction, I think.
So you just again mentioned Top Gun. Why don't you talk a little bit about the students that you encounter? Both Michelle and I teach in different capacities, and it seems like in a lot of ways over time, students have changed, especially for us in more recent years. But can you talk about that experience in working directly with the students and how maybe over the years they changed or you changed with them?
Sure. Well, so to that last point, I was at Top Gun from 2000 to 2002. And then later in 2006 to 2009, I was at the Weapons School, as it's called, which is like a Top Gun satellite at the base where I was stationed, which was in Lemoore, California, in the San Joaquin Valley. So my 2 years, I wouldn't say there was a big change in the mm-hmm. in the students. But one thing I recognized, being the son of a teacher in the Los Angeles school district system, and my wife was a kindergarten teacher for a number of years, is there are certain methods and techniques that you can use to be good with your students, particularly the ones that maybe don't want to be there. Mm-hmm. And I never had that at Top Gun. Everyone who came to Top Gun fought to get there and fought to do well and stay there. And I want to say in the 2.5 years I was there, I think we only sent maybe 3 students home. Mm-hmm. One had come off of a long period of not flying. And for some reason, he was nominated to attend the class. And he just wasn't proficient enough, getting back to something we, the three of us, have discussed before. Another just didn't, frankly, have the capability, which is really mm-hmm. sad, because he was a good F-18 pilot. And in fact, went on to command a squadron, but he just didn't have what Top Gun was looking for. So they sent him home. And I think a third one was a mix between a medical setback and something else. They sent him home and saying, "Hey, maybe come back in another class," and then just never did happen. And so they all wanted to be there. They were all eager to learn, and that was terrific. And so for me, I never had to motivate anyone. It was almost a function of, "Hey, you know, slow down. You're going to get all this. Let's concentrate on what you need to know, not everything there is to know." Mm-hmm. And so But I will say this about your question, because as I've retired in 2017, but stayed in sort of the industry in the Fighter Pilot podcast, I feel now like fighter pilots as a class are changing. And it's mm-hmm. not necessarily what you asked, but it's as close to an answer as I can get for you. Because in the 60s and 70s, it was a lot of chest thumping, you know, big burly guys who could pull a lot of G's and make split second decisions and you know, break things when they're in a china shop kind of thing. The fighter pilot of today is nothing like that. It's mm-hmm. it's men and women. It's people who are thinking more, not to say they didn't think back then, but it's more of a thinking game than a brute force game. Mm-hmm. And the F-35, for example, which I did not get a chance to fly, but what I've learned about it from the outside is it's not a, how can I make this F-4 or F-14 do what I want it to do with brute force, and maybe I'll move the flaps, even though they don't suggest you do that at high speeds or something. You know, like, what can I do to win? Now it's more a function of, okay, all this information is being presented to me. What do I need right in this moment to achieve whatever mission I've been sent out here to do. And that's a totally different way of approaching what would otherwise be a similar activity.
So my last question is around technology and how things are changing. What sort of impact do you think AI and also drone use and unmanned vehicles are going to have on the profession, really, of fighter pilots and what's done and what's expected?
Yes, that is a good question. And, all I can do is guess the future along with everybody else. But I'll say that the trends we're seeing, and particularly the conflict in Ukraine, suggests that it's going to be, I think, more so than ever before, a period of rapid iteration. What's working, what's not, how quickly can we pivot to something else instead of one very expensive single person aircraft that can go out and do this thing? What if we just overwhelm the defenses with hundreds or maybe thousands of these cheaper things, and maybe not all of them will work, but maybe enough will to still achieve the mission? Right now, you have an effort underway to sort of bridge that gap when it comes to full-size military aircraft with what they call the Collaborative Combat Aircraft, CCA, or otherwise known as a loyal wingman, which means maybe I'm flying along in my airplane and I have a wingman, which I always did in my career, but for the most part. But now there's nobody in that wingman. And it's almost a perfect wingman because it's going to be right where I expect it to be. It's going to do what I expect it to do. And oh, by the way, if we get shot at, it's going to make itself a beacon so it gets shot and not me. So it's better than a wingman. And there's a lot of technology, of course, that goes into that. And a lot of, I don't know what to call, not consternation, but there'll be a lot of, iterating on what does that mean? How really are we going to operate? So that could change the way that we fought, certainly when I was in the Navy, and the way we did air to air or air to surface or defensive counter air or whatever. Just within landing on the carrier itself has changed since I retired. Now they have a program called Precision Landing Mode that apparently makes carrier landings easy, which I still cannot get my head around. Because for us, it was always the 1,000-pound elephant in the room is, hey, yeah, we're going out on this flight, but guess what? We have to land at the end and it'll be dark. There's no moon and the seas are pitching. So I think it's changing. And again, all I can do is guess at what the future holds. But I wouldn't be surprised to see fewer of the high dollar capital asset aircraft and more of the lower, which seems to conflict with what we might have said 10 or 20 years ago. And maybe attrition will be acceptable. Certainly in the machines, not so much in the humans. We're a long way from June 6, 1944, when I think the plan was just keep sending our boys until someone breaks through. That does not seem to be the case in 2025.
It has been an absolute pleasure to speak, to learn about your vast career. Why don't you tell everybody where they can find you, where they can find the podcast, your book, and where they can connect with you?
Oh, thank you, Michelle. I appreciate that. So the website is fighterpilotpodcast.com. We're building a landing page there soon for my memoir, which is titled Through the Yellow Visor. And we are on, I wouldn't say all the social media. We do, I think, what, X, Facebook, and Instagram. We've come off a few others just because, I don't know, I'm not in the younger generation who's all over those. So, but yeah, the website's a good place to go. We also have a Patreon page where people can support the show and learn more and get inside baseball on what's coming up next and discussions and even live chats with me. And I'm excited about the book coming out. I think the end of March 2025, maybe early April. And it again, it tells my story. And part of what I hope it does is is motivate people to pursue their dreams like I did mine, and to not give up. So to be tenacious and persistent. It also, I hope, dispels some of the stereotypes that Hollywood insists on bestowing on fighter pilots. And I hope it's just a fun read. I poke some fun at myself. I probably point out more of my setbacks than my triumphs. But as you heard earlier, that's just who I am. So certainly listeners of the show are ready for it to come out. Even others who maybe are given it, I hope will read it and enjoy it because if you've got a dream, chase it. because it is worth chasing. And you don't want to, I don't think, be where I am now in my mid-50s. And, let's say I'd gone into banking or something else instead. I might think, gosh, what if I had tried to pursue being a fighter pilot? I did, and it worked. It doesn't for everybody, but it did for me. And I was glad I was able to. And now I'm glad I'm able to share that world with folks like your listeners. Thank you very much. And the listeners of the Fighter Pilot Podcast. So it has been my pleasure.
Excellent. And we will link to all of that in the episode description. I do actually have to ask one more thing. When you were flying, did you feel like the Navy felt that you were more valuable than the plane, or the plane was more valuable than you?
I would say the Navy, for the most part, believed that I was more valuable, but that doesn't mean you can just recklessly break the thing and not, walk away without any talking to. But no, I always felt that they treasured me, the human, more than the machine.
Good, good,
I'm so
good.
glad to hear that one.
Yeah. All right. Well, Vincent, thank you so much for taking your time to be with us and share your stories with our listeners. And we wish you great success with the book, and maybe we'll catch you in the skies on one of your commercial flights.
I hope so, Eric. Thank you very much. Thank you as well, Michelle.
All right. Thanks so much.